May I go back to my more general framework here?
For sure. Yeah.
Okay. The detail you're looking at and the phenomena we're talking about in the Middle East and in Iraq may be said to have originated in Iraq about close to over 4,000 years ago in every detail with an empire that I was happened to be just reading today, it so happens. I was looking up to see, after all, what Wikipedia and the net had to say about empire, something I've been studying for quite a while, but I wanted to see what they said about it. And I notice in the Wikipedia entry, which is very interesting, when they look at the rise of empires, they talk about Sargon I in the 24th century BC. So that's, you know, over 4,000 years ago, almost 5,000. Now, they don't actually say where that one was in Wikipedia, but my best guess would be it's what came to be known as Mesopotamia or Iraq. I think Sargon we're talking about, let me turn out to be wrong, but I think that's Iraq, basically. And, you know, Babylon, Nineveh, you know, the biblical things much later, they get those names. And Sumer, the first empire, I think one of the first empires was Sumer. We can look this up, see if I'm right.
I will when you tell me.
But anyway, Sumer was definitely early Iraq. And what I've read about the empire then sounds exactly like imperial operations ever since. In every part of the world, in every century, in every millennium since, the imperial operations involve rival groups using violence, using murder, coups, intrigue, bribery, and alliances of various shifting alliances, shifting military tactics, and so forth. Let me go back. You said make it simple, and let me say some things that I would now say about empire, and partly having just read this entry today, which gives a 5,000-year sweep rather quickly, but a lot of which I would have said earlier. I've spent a lot of time defining what I mean by covert, but what I mean is deceptive, you know, lying, false. All right. In two major dimensions, I want to say. The policy is false, is deceptive, is covert, what its aims are, what it's aiming, and so forth. And the means are covert. It's not just the means. The policy as a whole is covert, meaning we're doing something, different purposes, different allies, different from what we claim to the public. We have a different nature. The government is different from what we think, and what they say it is, and what we believe from what they say, okay? So I'm saying now something different from what I would have understood 10 years ago. Everybody knows, I've known the covert aspect for 30 or 40 years, partly from a book, by the way, that I can refer you to and others to, called, we'll come back to that. Name skips my mind at the moment. But anyway, which defined, A Short Course in the Secret War. That's the name of it. A Short Course in the Secret War by an early OSS and then OPC and CIA covert operator who used a pseudonym, and one can now find the pseudonym he used was Christopher Felix. And I looked up in the web just the other day, real name of Christopher Felix, and the real name is now known. A Short Course in the Secret War, and he makes the big point about the difference between, that I was describing, between secret and covert, covert being a category of secret operation. Now, from that time on, I understood that CIA does covert operations that cannot be attributed to the U.S., attributable to the U.S., but above all, not attributable to the president. All right? Okay? Are you with me, or are you looking up something?
I got the...
look it up if you want.
I got Sargon. You're going to find this.
Where is Sargon?
Continue, though.
Am I wrong?
What's interesting, I don't know about this, but Sargon was the king of Akkadia, A-K-K-A-D.
Oh, Akkadia. I'd be wrong here.
Akkadia.
Yeah, look. That is spoken in ancient Mesopotamia.
Right.
That's what I said.
But
Mesopotamia is Iraq.
Is an extinct East
Semitic language.
Semitic language.
But it was spoken in ancient Mesopotamia.
Right.
So he was in Mesopotamia, Uruk, Sumer, overlord of Sumer. Okay? So I was right. I hadn't looked it up. He was noted for his conquest of the Sumerian city-states in the 24th and 23rd centuries B.C., okay? So, just make the point. Cradle of civilization, Iraq, this is the first empire. And what makes it an empire? Because he's ruling kings. He's an emperor because he is a ruler of kings, which are people in city-states in Sumer, which are different ethnicities, different regions, but he rules over them, right? Mm-hmm. He's the king of kings.
Right.
Okay? So it's ethnically diverse to some degree. And it's a kingdom of kingdoms, okay? Now, in the first empire, in effect, 24th BC. Now, follow me. Here's the simple part. What's new for me to realize is that our government is not a government with a covert operations agency named the CIA. It's a government within which has a covert foreign policy, which is different from what it says, and for reasons I'll come back to in a minute. Well, different from what it says. The actual policy is covert. It's lied about with evidence, mm-hmm. not just by assertions, but
right.
in ways, plausibly, that will convince people of the lies.
Right.
Okay? Now, and that is not just because it has a covert operations agency, like the CIA, which on its face would seem to be at odds with
right.
democracy, because democracy in principle is sovereignty of the public. Public has to be informed as to what the alternative policies are,
right.
what they're doing, so forth. If you have an agency that lies to the public and has secretly, isn't that contradictory to democracy? Well, yeah, people sort of indicate, but in a dangerous world, you have to have that, okay? You have to have it because you need to do things that can't be acknowledged because they're criminal. They're against our ideals. They can be described as evil or murderous, but whether they're not, and they're in a better cause, or for our benefit, they're lesser evils, but they are illegal, even in our domestic law and in international law. So we have to lie about them. Now, people understand very well that in war, you do things that are not legal in peacetime, right? It's understood. And you do them to your enemies, for your benefit, for your security, right? So you kill people, but it's not murder. In peacetime would be murder, but in wartime it's not murder, okay? And people understood that when you're fighting a dangerous enemy, you've got to fight dirty, especially if he's dirty. And even if he doesn't fight dirty, he may be very strong, and we have to fight dirty. So we can't be bound by legality, okay? That's almost universally accepted in every country, not just in ours. In wartime, no rules. You don't go by Marcus of Queensbury rules in wartime. How about in peacetime? What about in peacetime? Well, most emperors have not pretended to democracy or legality, so they don't have anything to apologize for if they do whatever, you know, bound by constraint in peacetime or wartime. They say the king rules by divine right, and whatever he does is what God wanted him to do, basically, divine, or at least he wants him to do to stay in power. We okay here?
Yep.
Okay. What about, however, an empire that is democratic at home, that does pretend to legality, rules and rule of law at home, and what are called democratic virtues and democratic popular sovereignty and so forth? Let's call it a liberal empire, like the British Empire. It's a liberal empire. Now what I'm saying is, the U.S. had a covert foreign policy. The foreign policy is not what the president or the State Department says it is. It is not ever what a public affairs officer says it is. The policy is always different from that. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying much more than the fact that I used to think, I've learned much more than that, that it has a covert component. Mm-hmm. That's well known. Everybody knows, they don't generally know what covert means in the way I've just described it. They don't understand that it means not just secret, but lying, and explicitly lying. Mm-hmm. Anything secret, if it's very secret, has to be protected by some lies, such as if somebody asks you, do you know of this report,
right,
which you've just read or written? And you have to say no, because the existence of that report is secret. So to keep that secret, you have to lie about what you know and what you think and so forth. But I'm saying more than that. A covert policy, which is not merely secret, is lying from start to finish. I conceive of the American foreign policy as being in the service of covert empire. Covert in two senses. And first, let me say that the word covert means not only secret, or sometimes synonymous with clandestine, but clandestine in particular sounds like secret operations, operations that you keep secret from the public. And that includes a lot of military planning, for example, which has to be secret from the enemy. But covert implies that it's not merely secret, but that it's accompanied by a cover story, a false account of every aspect of the policy, which is meant to deceive the domestic public, not merely foreigners and not merely adversaries, and may or may not be known to allies in a secret basis, but to deceive them as to what the policy is, what the targets are, what you're trying to achieve, what the interests are that press toward this policy, and what the means are. And above all, to conceal who is running it. In the first instance, to conceal the fact that your own country, I'll talk now about the U.S., that the U.S. is responsible for events and for operations. It's to the cover story is meant to imply that some agency other than the U.S. government is involved here. It might be a U.S. corporation, but more likely it's a non-American element of some kind, sometimes called false flag, where you pretend to be some other army altogether if it's a military operation. But in general, it's happening outside the direction of the U.S. government, when in fact it is being financed, planned, and directed by an agency of the U.S. government. Second, even more secret is the fact that it's run by the president, at the top, that it is controlled by civilian authority and is not a rogue operation by a U.S. operation, by a U.S. agency, I'm sorry. Above all, it must be dissociated from the White House. And so that the president, even if it does come out that the first cover story is misleading and it was, after all, an American initiative, there are other cover stories, and cover stories within cover stories, that imply that it is not the president. If it is found to be American at all, it's American other than the president. So the president will not be accountable for this policy, will not have to defend it to Congress, will not have to run on it if he has another election coming up. His party will not be held accountable for it, and he will not be held before history to be accountable for it. Now, why that's so important, I'll come to in a moment. But the point here, estimate, is that when I call it covert or when they call it covert, what they mean is, above all, the president must not be held credited or blamed for this policy. And in general, the U.S. is not to be blamed altogether, if possible. So, but if they are running it, that means you have to prepare a series of falsehoods. That means you don't merely swear people to secrecy. You don't merely keep the documents relating to this like a military plan under lock and key and make them known only to people with security clearances who are very reliable, etc., and the smallest number of people altogether. All of that is true. It is secret. But it goes beyond that. It means that in this case, you absolutely prepare and plan misleading evidence as to who is running this and what it is and why they're running it, so that if it is known, as it may often be known, that something has happened here, some people have acted, you have evidence, false evidence or misleading evidence, that it was someone other than the people who actually were running it, which starts with the president.
The Church Report, which brought out a lot of this stuff, including in particular the Mongoose operation, the regime change operation in 1962 under Kennedy.
And that came out, if anyone wanted to look it up.
It came out in 1976.
Okay.
Well, he did a series of reports. The commission worked in 75, 76. And some of his reports, including, I think, the assassination report, may have come out in 75. Some came out in 76. Okay. And then there was a Pike report at the same time. Otis Pike in the House was doing a similar investigation. And that report was never officially released, but was leaked to Daniel Shore, who gave it to them. So it is available on the web, the Pike report.
Okay.
These were major exposés of our covert operations. Late in the game, see, in 75. So I would say that was, these others were books. That was a congressional investigation, and the only real and big investigation of the intelligence community that there ever was. And it led to the setting up of the so-called oversight committees, churches worked in, which essentially now have ever operated ever since as public relations arms of the intelligence community. They've been totally co-opted. They are black holes of information as far as the public is concerned. And in general, they defend the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
Just like so many regulatory agencies are captured by the industries that they supposedly regulate,
mm-hmm.
In part by offering them great jobs, people, you know, big jobs in the Federal Food and Drug Administration,
FCC.
Our trade representatives for the president, I've just noticed, nearly all become major lobbyists afterwards for the trade associations. So, likewise, the Intelligence Committee are basically lobbyists in the government and then later after the government, for the Intelligence Community. We don't have a foreign policy that uses, in part, covert operations in peacetime as in wartime. In wartime, every country has a covert operations, even whether they're an empire or not. In peacetime, empires have covert operations. For a variety of reasons. But it goes beyond that. We have the purposes of those covert operations, the purposes of our foreign policy in general, are different from what we say. They are not to improve our national security. To a large extent, they endanger our national security by tolerating or provoking or promoting threats to our existence. Without our foreign policy, there would not be 5,000 Soviet missiles aimed at us that could destroy the world, including us, any day. Those wouldn't exist if our foreign policy was different. And if our foreign policy was aimed primarily at preventing the United States from facing an existential, by which I mean survival, physical survival to the last human, if it were aimed at preventing threats to our physical survival, it could easily have been oriented toward preventing the existence of what at one point was about 30,000 Soviet weapons. But that existence is a collateral accepted by our policy because it's a price of our foreign policy, which is for our own benefit. It's not based on our security. It is not oriented toward democracy in the underdeveloped worlds. It's against democracy generally, with a few odd exceptions where democracy does serve our purposes. It is not for independence. No, our policy is aimed at buying dependence and assuring that these people are dependent on us and not independent. And if they act independently, we change their leadership. Regime change is another word for an imperial policy. In short, Clausewitz said, war, he's often quoted as saying, war is the continuation of politics by other means. I've studied Clausewitz, by the way, when I was in the military. That's a misquotation. It's a bad translation. A better translation of Clausewitz is, on his book being titled On War.
Who's Clausewitz?
Karl Clausewitz was a Prussian military strategist and analyst and a historian, and sort of the most well-known Bible font of practical judgments like Machiavelli in the military field. So Clausewitz is always quoted by almost any military strategist or analyst of any kind. So Clausewitz is very often quoted as saying, war is a continuation of politics by other means. That's, as I say, a mistranslation. What he actually said is better translated as follows. War is a continuation of politics, by which he meant to say, by the way, you know, policy matters. It isn't just strategy, but what is the leadership of the country trying to achieve? What's its overall policy? What are its interests in the world? Not just how to win, but, you know, why you want to win, why you're at war at all, what you're trying to achieve by the war, what you want to happen after the war, all that, okay? By politics, he meant policy in a large sense. And he meant to imply the political leaders, whether they're civilians or military, the political leaders of the country must determine the policy, and the military simply serve that, okay? Now, what he said was, war is a continuation of politics with an admixture of other means.
With an admixture?
Admixture. It's not a familiar word, but it's as good. An addition of other means. The point being, what are the other means? Military attacks, naval attacks, armies, war. You know, in other words, so he said, you're trying to achieve the same kind of aims you do in peacetime, but you add... He didn't have bombing then, but now he would say bombing. You add military invasions. You know, you add strategy. You add deployments. You add production and so forth. In addition to what you do in peacetime, which is elections, alliances, marriages, you know, dynastic marriages, and all that. All the stuff you do in peacetime, you do in wartime, but you add some other things. And he was thinking of, actually, he was mainly an analyst of Napoleon's campaigns. So Napoleon adds, you know, to dynastic marriages, he adds invasions. And he adds them, you know, by the way, he invented something new by the levy en masse, essentially a draft. He adds popular mass, not just mercenaries, okay? What I'm saying is empire is a continuation of politics with an admixture of other means. Means that are not admissible in non-imperial domestic politics. They're not uncommon in the sense of murder or bribery. They happen, but they're not legitimized. They're supposedly prosecuted or banned when you find out about them. You know, it happens so far. It's supposedly you have a rule of law. But in empire, you add other means. The murder, invasions, other things. I think
I have, for all these years, been thinking about nuclear weapons as somewhat by themselves, isolated from the nature of our foreign policy. And this is helpful, what we've been talking about, because it's new for me to realize that our, among the admixture of other means that is involved in not just foreign policy, but very specifically our imperial foreign policy, and that means our effective dominion over other countries that are nominally independent of us. They are not states, they're not territories, but we control or have a very strong or powerful influence on their politics, their regimes, their policies. Our policy is an imperial policy because it has to do with control of other countries, and not just influence, but control, and specifically control by means that include both military means, as in Iraq, but covert means throughout, and the covert involved a heavy influence of violence. We added airplanes along with the British. So bombing, actual bombing, has been a major other means of empire, and of course the threat of air power. But actually, not just the threat, but actually doing it. Drones now are a marvelous new invention that adds to it. The kind of surveillance we have now is a new means of empire. What, very quickly here, what Ed Snowden, what Chelsea Manning showed by millions, or hundreds of thousands, I should say, of cables, was the U.S. as an empire, how we run the world, or much of the world, and how we find ourselves involved in so much of the world. But since he was only dealing at the secret level, Chelsea Manning, she was only dealing at the secret level, then Bradley Manning, you did get a surprising amount of assassination involved in there and torture, but major bribery, for instance, wasn't shown at the secret level. Okay. Snowden comes along and shows that we're not only listening to our own citizens and we're not only listening to our enemies, we're listening to the whole world. Why? Because we want to run the world. Surveillance is a tool of manipulation and bribery and blackmail all over the world. And that's of interest to us because we're an imperial power and we want to run the world, to order the world to the greatest extent possible to serve our major interests, including, as I say, corporate interests, but also definitely, as we've said, the interests of politicians to stay in office, the interests of military to have bigger budgets and bigger, et cetera, et cetera. A variety of interests, but they're not general national interests. Okay. What I now realize my book is about is that in 1945, one other means was added of empire. And now something I see more clearly than I ever before saw was it hasn't turned out, despite Hiroshima, in the eyes of our civilian leaders, that we can actually explode nuclear weapons on people, especially once the Russians got nuclear weapons. It's just too dangerous, and it kills too many people at a time, even from our civilian leadership, which is quite ruthless. We're willing to kill an awful lot of people indirectly and through bombing in general, but nuclear weapons, which are proposed and urged by the military, which does not share this inhibition, the civilians have seen that the nuclear just kill too many people. As I say, our bombing in World War II killed, let me say it again, 1.7 million people, civilians, right? 1.7 million, about the same as Auschwitz. But a nuclear weapon, one nuclear weapon, drops near 1.7 million people,
kills 1.7 million people, a big, a good size nuclear weapon. We used to have 10 and 20 megaton weapons, mostly now they're smaller. But the ones we had in the 50s and early 60s, if you drop them near 10 million people, they kill 10 million people. One weapon. And we had at one point 30,000 nuclear weapons, mostly smaller than that, but thousands of that size. Too big. The military were willing to do it. Some people in the military, not everybody. But General Curtis LeMay, various others, a few others, were willing to think of a nuclear war. The civilians weren't. But the means that nuclear era gave, put in the hands of our civilian leaders, was the threat of nuclear weapons. And that they've used frequently. And to, usually secretly, to support imperial purposes. Usually secretly, and for reasons quite differently from what they told the public, when they told the public at all, they have threatened nuclear weapons. And what's clearer to me than it was even a year ago, after 40 years of thinking about this, what's clearer to me now is that in the minds of our civilian leaders, the threat of nuclear weapons is quite a distinct instrument, a distinctly different instrument from the actual launching of nuclear weapons. And however, it contains a risk of launching nuclear weapons, which they're willing to accept. So they do accept a risk as opposed to a zero risk that this will lead to nuclear war, but they hope that it's low enough that they can accept it and it serves their purposes. And it serves the variety of purposes that their other imperial instruments do. It's a variety of purposes. Mm-hmm. Corporate interests, but also staying in office, having allies of various kinds, satisfying allies, very distinctly maintaining a major hegemonic role in Europe without being an actual European power. Nuclear weapons have been critical to our economic and political dominance in Europe. In a non-nuclear age, we would have influence because we're the biggest trading nation, we're the biggest investment nation, especially early on. That's less true now. But we wouldn't have the degree of influence that we actually do have. And that has always been true. That for reasons of cover story, for a variety of myths, have led to our being the power, along with France now and England, but the power that provides nuclear weapons to the NATO alliance. Is the NATO alliance really needed nuclear weapons? No, but we pretended that they did, and given that they did, we were the power to provide those, and we still are. The British have some nuclear weapons now at sea, and submarines, the French have some nuclear weapons, but there's a couple hundred land-based nuclear weapons in Europe, and they're all American right now. And Poland likes them because they think of them as protecting them. Well, nuclear weapons could protect Poland from Russia only at the cost of ending life on Earth. So the Poles are interested in our having a doomsday machine to keep Russians out of Poland. And, who wants to really start a Poland? No, we'll never have a president, I don't think, I hope, who is like Curtis LeMay, who really can imagine, to our profit, triggering a doomsday machine. We do have, we will have, and we have had presidents who, for a variety of political interests, domestic and external, want a doomsday machine. It's the only kind of nuclear machine you can have threatening Russia. We could have a few nuclear weapons to threaten anybody else. But Russia, with its nuclear weapons, we can only seek to influence by a big nuclear arsenal. That's a doomsday machine. They'd rather have it than not have it, even if the cost is the Russians having one as well.
They've always made that choice, and they're making it right now under Barack Obama. Certainly Hillary will make that choice. Certainly any Republican will make that choice. And that's true not only the next 4 years, but I would guess, unless something really changes the world, 8 years, 10 years, 16 years, whatever. As far as we can see, unless there's some really currently unforeseeable change in the situation. So, in short, the H-bomb put a doomsday machine in the hands of American leaders and later the Russian leaders. They've had it ever since. So far, the French and England have not had enough to have the doomsday machine that they want. So far. They don't have that much of an independent policy anyway, because of our dominance. Okay. We are not the worst empire we've ever been. We're not the best, however you measure that. We're not an exceptional empire. We're an unexceptional empire with two differences. One, air power. We also have naval power, but the British had that. So the new part is air power and nuclear, thermonuclear weapons. And the Russians have that now too, but not, you know, they're in a different situation to a large extent. They don't have a worldwide empire. We do. And we have had it for a long time. And part of the way we maintain that empire is with our Navy and our Air Force, but in particular with nuclear weapons. But what are those nuclear weapons? By the way, other countries have nuclear weapons, but they don't have an overseas empire. We do. We maintain that overseas influence and influence in part not by the likelihood that we will initiate nuclear war, but by the possibility that we will initiate nuclear war as a threat. And that threat is a major part of a president's arsenal at this point. And if he gave it up, he would be fired in favor of somebody who maintained it.
You have to realize that the madman theory was in the minds of all of these presidents.
Right.
It is always, nuclear development has always depended, since the Second World War, and especially since the Soviets had the chance of responding with nuclear weapons, which is 1949-50. So for the last 60 years, then, it's not just Nixon. All of the presidents have relied on a madman theory to get their way. That's the first point.
Right.
And second, since, and that means they weren't as mad as if they wanted to go to nuclear war, they were just pretending to be mad enough to be willing and thus get their way. And they got some benefits out of that, a number of which were good. However, when I look at the actual risks they were running, which was not zero, and it was not one in a million either, and it was not, in several cases, one in a thousand. Maybe it was one in a hundred. Maybe it was 10 in a hundred. I'm saying it was mad in a human sense. Mad of the society, a mad establishment, a mad administration, a mad president, to be following that policy. In fact, it was mad to be following an imperial policy which incorporated nuclear threats in a world where there was a possibility of a nuclear response ever since 1950. Before that, it was murderous, but empires have always been murderous. But now it was species suicidal in a way that was never possible before.
Right.
And I'm saying for the last 60 years, this world has been in the grip of madmen and of a mad psychosis of the public to be willing to allow them to do that.
So bring that home to me.
Humanity's gone crazy.
We would rather have Russia with the ability to destroy the United States as it has, along with our ability to destroy the world, than to have neither of us able to destroy the world. That's what I'm saying. Now, there we get right into my book. I'm saying we have always chosen a Russian nuclear massive posture along with ours, rather than to restrain ours with the benefit of restraining theirs. On the contrary, we don't want to restrain theirs. It gives us a good excuse for having ours built up, for our sins. We could always have chosen one that restrained both powers to a degree where neither of us where we were no longer under a threat of total annihilation. We've never chosen that. We've always preferred them to have whatever they want so that we could have whatever we want, which is even more on the whole than they do. So security is not... our foreign policy has been at the price and the conscious price of a development of a Soviet and now Russian capability to annihilate the U.S. and, in fact, the rest of the world. It's been at the price of a Soviet doomsday machine and now a Russian doomsday machine, which followed ours in every respect, but is now fully the equal of ours. One of the few areas of Russian economics or military or anything else that is the equal of ours. They don't have a navy equal to ours, even remotely.
Right.
They no longer have an army.
You're basically saying
But their nuclear is equal to ours.
You're basically saying the Cold War was a bunch of baloney.
No, it was a bunch of, what I'm saying is a covert policy.
It was
The Cold War was wrongly mistakenly represented as what the alternatives were, what the arms were, what the interests were, what the means were. Everything about it was a lie.
So,
as in the case of the Vietnam War, the
danger of all-out nuclear war, leading to near extinction of the human species, is significant right now and always has been larger than people thought. It's probably less in some respects than it was earlier during the height of the Cold War, but still is not zero and could be made. The possibility of nuclear winter could be made virtually zero, very close to zero, by changes that would be easy to describe and easy to accomplish if the decision were made. Much easier to deal with, for example, than climate change.
Right.
Take much less, it would involve much less activity by many things. Could be done and should be done. We've been closer to nuclear war than almost anyone realizes over the last 40, 50 years. 70 years, really. We've been closer to it. The chance is not going away because the motives that brought us close in the past and the interests persist as before, and they're generally not recognized even.
So the bulletin of atomic scientists moved the clock up to 3 minutes to 12.
Is right.
Which they moved it up 3 minutes, I believe, from where it was previously.
Yeah.
And this is the closest to midnight it's ever been, correct?
Yes. Now, I think what that means is they rarely spell out very much. And by the way, I think they are including climate in that
issue. They are.
As well as nuclear. It used to be just nuclear. But I doubt if they would say our awareness of what's involved in nuclear war has grown very much, especially 30 years ago, but in particular, the scientific awareness has grown just in the last few years, literally 5 years or so, and is not generally known at all. And that may be one of the things they're looking at. The likelihood of an all-out war has not grown. If anything, as I say, it's probably diminished somewhat, but not anywhere to near zero. Now, what is near zero? What probability of all-out nuclear war, which could happen any minute as we speak? We're poised for it. The weapons are there. They're on hair trigger alert. A false alarm could set it off at any time. It's not a matter of capabilities that don't yet exist. They exist and they're unstable right now. But just like the next train wreck, you might say, you know, just waiting to happen. But what probability of that is tolerable? Doesn't require radical measures or urgent measures to take. Is 1 in 100 something you can live in? 1 in 1,000? 1 in 1,000,000? I would say, you know, when we're talking 1 in a million cases of all-out nuclear war next year or in the next 10 years or something, almost anything higher than zero is intolerable. But then lots of things are intolerable, you can say. What is the priority of dealing with them?
So you started off by...
I think it is. I regard it as an urgent problem now, although it is not generally so regarded. It's not on our agenda. It will not be a major subject of discussion next year in the campaign, no matter what I did this year. Other events in the world could make it a subject, but I can't make it a subject next year. A nuclear weapon going off, or real fighting with Russia breaking out in a big way, will bring the subject up.
I don't see human species getting away with the technical, and with a lot of things, with population size, with distribution of power, but especially with nuclear weapons, with climate change. While the U.S. of A. retains its current imperial mindset, either the imperial mindset changes, as it has changed in various countries, or we go down
as it was before. Right. And I would say it's an intolerable, intolerable risk to live with.
You're getting me here in my scholarly research mode, my political mode, addressing the question of does the public and do scholars in general understand, as I see it, you know, from my perspective, what was going on here? And I'm saying, no, these scoundrels, now I may sound in the tone of voice as though I regard them as happy-go-lucky, funny scoundrels. No, they're mass murderers. That's who we're talking about. Sorry if I have a smile on my face here when I say it. Context of our discussion is that I'm saying, this is fucking life.
Right.
Not that it's acceptable. Yeah. It's horrible. It's why the human species is drifting toward extinction. That is why we are drifting toward extinction. Do I feel happy about that? No. Mm-hmm. But we're having an intellectual discussion here for a moment of why I think the way I do. My joking here is a way of fighting off despair.